Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me. Is this room 512?
Pardon?
Is this room 512? Okay. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to start with, so the chapbook that I put together called Brazilian is Not a Race is made up of 30 sonnets. I'm going to start by reading sonnets 16 through 23, and then I'm going to read some newer stuff. But again, thanks for having me and Oki, and it's really nice to get to read with Oki. I think this is the first time I've ever read with you. Yeah, we've been friends a long time and doing this together a long time, but it's the first time. Okay, so this is from Brazilian is Not a Race, number 16. A border-like race is a cruel fiction, maintained by constant policing, violence always threatening a new map. It takes time, lots of people's time, to organize the world this way. And violence, it takes more violence. Violence no one can confuse for anything but violence. So much violence changes relationships, births a people they can reason with. These people are not us. They underestimate the violence. It's been a while. We are who we are to them, even when we don't know who we are to each other, and culture is a record of us figuring that out. 17. Why didn't Anzaldúa write about the Plan of San Diego? She mentions Mexican-American resistors robbed a train in Brownsville in October 1915, and the brutality of white vigilante groups and Texas Rangers that followed. But she says nothing of the plan, its appeal to all factions of the Mexican Revolution to cooperate in a struggle against the United States, the way it echoed writings in Ricardo Flores Magón's newspaper De Generación, which had its share of subscribers in the valley. 18. One of those subscribers, Aniceto Pisaña, wrote a 21-verse poem about leaving San Benito after suffering anti-Mexican abuse. He says, with suffering and pain that grows greater, I say that there are Mexicans who hate and despise their own race to lick the feet of the Americans. It's hard to say who precisely Pisaña is referring to when he says Mexicans, and there's a familiar conflation of nationality and race, but the lack of solidarity among people of Mexican descent against Anglos. 19. It's still like that. Pisaña moved away from San Benito, in any case, and settled in Brownsville, where he did find like-minded people who also subscribed to De Generación, like Emilia Rodriguez, a widow who supported herself as a seamstress and took part in a women's discussion group. She might have especially appreciated the September 3rd issue in 1910, its front page coverage of both ethnic exclusions of Mexicans by whites in Texas and Mujer Moderna's editor living in exile in San Antonio. 20. According to passengers who survived the attack and robbery of the train Anzaldúa mentions in Borderlands, the resistors' chants included, Viva Aniceto Pisaña. It makes sense. A posse of Anglos that included Texas Rangers and other officials had raided his ranch just 2 months before. Pisaña and some of his friends shot and killed one of the men and wounded three others in the process, then escaped. Pisaña later claimed the raid drove him to join the Plan of San Diego, though he'd been the Anglos' nightmare long before. 21. Lots of people don't talk about the Plan of San Diego. Take back Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Wyoming, and California, annex six more states for an independent republic of black people, return to the Apaches their land, kill all white American males over the age of 16. That's the plan. To some people, it just doesn't sound real. But I agree with the historian Gerald Horn, even if the plan was a fiction, massacres of various sorts were not. Neither was a temporary halt of economic development. 22. 1915 to 1917, the valley was a virtual war zone. Whether that was the plan or only looked like part of the plan, the effects reached well beyond the valley, in part because some feared Germany and Japan were behind it. But black militancy on the rise at the time gave the plan resonance and terrified Washington. It wasn't just that Afro-Mexicans and African-Americans living in the U.S. might join the movement. They feared mutiny. They feared black soldiers who were typically stationed in the borderlands around that time. 23. No one remembers the Alamo or Vicente Guerrero or the ban on communication between Mexicans and slaves in parts of Texas. I don't know how much it matters, but I imagine a valley where you learn about the plan growing up and the Buffalo soldiers of the 24th Infantry who marched on Jim Crow Houston's predominantly black San Felipe district and opened fire on the police. I imagine life in that valley and how it would be harder to not hear these stories in that place. It's hard to imagine, but I try. Okay. So this next one, these are all newer things. A friend of mine did this project where she wrote poems and then she had people respond to those poems in poem. And so this is this is my response to this poem called Finger Trap by Raquel Salas Rivera. Should you put a ring on it, spiral out, forget, this is another becoming you turn in, like Lucille Clifton turning into her own, turning on into her own self, at last turning out of the white cage, turning out of the lady cage, turning at last. A person born with 12 fingers isn't a metaphor for anything, but if you would like her to, she'll read your palm. When you meet her, that's what she says. It's 2008, not too long before the stock market crash. At a poetry retreat in an offensively named town where timeshare people go to ski and dream about Aspen. Around this time, you love Charles Simic's translation of Vasco Popa's sequence, The Little Box, more than just about any other book of poems. The little box can be anywhere and nowhere. You can store and lose the entire world inside her as the little box falls in love with herself and conceives a little box that falls in love with herself and conceives. Infinite little boxes. You maintain that sequence is good, but in retrospect, your love of the little box seems like a compromise. So many young poets you meet between 2004 and 2008 have been influenced by Michael Hamburger's translations of poems by Paul Celan, but you can't read those beautiful translations without remembering what the poet Joe Enderoth said about Celan's suicide note to his wife. All it said was her name in all light. It may be written in French. The historical context of Celan's poems, you can't stop thinking about this. At the same time, a significant number of young writers, many of them teenage girls, are chatting online with Tao Lin or some other depressed man in his early 20s. They call this alt-lit. This is before one alt-lit woman turns up in an anarchist space in San Francisco and starts sleeping with one of the editors of a communist journal called Endnotes. But after Kenneth Goldsmith, taking a page out of the neocon playbook, transcribes the September 11th, 2001 issue of the New York Times and publishes The Day. At the same time, more and more young artists and writers move to East Austin. It is recommended that you spend a few good years teaching English in Korea or Japan. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians are killed by the United States. If talking about the past historically doesn't mean recognizing it the way it really was, to what extent does it involve something like translation? Does translation require a person or just language anymore? What is the legal age of consent in New Jersey and New York? These, perhaps, were some of the big questions some people were asking. Providing scientific articles to those at elite universities in the first world, but not to children in the global south, that was another. Aaron Schwartz left Reddit. Open access is nothing like an exhibit at a museum. It's not even like a museum membership, not even like a highway shut down. The tech buses have been around longer than many people think. Fukuyama had predicted an obsession with form removed from anything like political life, as if the hipsters of the mid-aughts would invent nihilism. Some poets begin to speak in terms of a sincerity-irony binary. It's possible the binary doesn't apply to anything of note. Not even in the always late United States where young people in black fuck up Starbucks in the Gap during the 1999 WTO protests in Seattle. Then again, some of them claim a swastika can be ironic, while others claim it's merely cultural, which is to say marginalized people should calm down, which is to suggest a swastika is a swastika is a swastika, which is to say it's the swastika you're afraid of, what the swastika can do, and not the history of the people who make it what is it, what it is, which is not over, which is dead wrong. Okay, just want to make sure I have. Okay, and this next one is called Summer 2016. Just trying to get these sorted out. Okay. Summer 2016. It's 11:30 in San Francisco. Britain has voted to leave the EU. Last week, the Golden State Warriors lost to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. We watched the game on a flat-screen TV set up outside a bookstore in downtown Oakland, right next to a vegetarian Chinese restaurant that had been shot up during a vigil the week before. Josh wants Cleveland to win, mostly for Tamir Rice, mostly hoping black people in Cleveland can finally get their riot. I want that too. This is a week after I turned 38 and 49 gay and queer men and women, mostly Latino, mostly Puerto Rican, are killed during a mass shooting at a gay nightclub on Latino Night in Orlando, right down the street from where the contestant of a popular reality TV show had been shot and killed by her stalker the night before. Not too far from a Disney resort where five alligators are captured and gutted by authorities looking for the remains of a two-year-old boy who was dragged in by an alligator a couple of days later. This is the same month a gorilla born and raised in a zoo in the place I was born and raised is killed at the Cleveland Zoo after a toddler falls into the gorilla exhibit and the gorilla drags him around. Later that week, Jane Goodall calls a zoo to say it looked like the gorilla was trying to protect the boy. I don't know. This is weeks before the white nationalists with the traditionalist workers' party stab anti-racists who stop them from holding a rally in Sacramento, before a frightening number of people argue the rights of the white nationalists were violated like that's a bad thing. This is after a crowd of mostly teenagers, mostly non-white, chase supporters of Donald Trump's presidential campaign out of San Jose. After someone takes a picture of a white kid running frantically away from a group of non-white kids running after him. This is the same month it's announced that Puerto Rico's water will no longer be monitored for quality because having defaulted on its debt, the country can't afford it. After the murder of two activists who exposed the contamination of Flint, Michigan's water supply. After militiamen open carry as they deliver bottled water to Flint residents. And I am writing from the future where all over the United States, black people are blocking highways and carrying guns to protest where the cops can see them. This is the week cell phone videos of two black men being murdered by cops go viral on consecutive days, before Micah X. Johnson kills five cops in Dallas during a Black Lives Matter march. This is a couple of weeks after teachers block highways in Oaxaca and an anarchist is arrested and run over. And I keep thinking I will call this 11:30 because that's the time I started writing, one night a month ago. And it's something I will come back to, more like a work day than a ray of light through a cloud. I guess that's what feels different. Like highways full of people there's no way around and barricades and teenagers setting cop cars on fire. It's inevitable. Maybe we'll see each other. Okay. Okay, so I'm gonna read next these sonnets that I've been working on. They're just about popular culture. It's really not that complicated. Okay, so popular culture. One, no matter how much you feel it, you want to feel it even more. That's the feeling Tony Bennett says he sees in Amy Winehouse when they meet to record Body and Soul in March 2011 for Bennett's album Duets 2. All this for an honest recording. She'll be gone by August. The album will debut at number one in September. Her parents will accept a Grammy on her behalf in February 2012. What can I say, her father will say. Long live Whitney Houston, long live Amy Winehouse, long live Etta James, but they'll all be dead. Two, no, this is happening, even if no one takes any notice of it, this is happening. Josh says the top comment on the Oasis supersonic music video on YouTube claims Oasis songs were anthems for the English working class. It's as simple as that. Sometimes you look back on your life and you have to be honest. That was an amazing band with a really unique sound it's hard not to get excited about even now. Who doesn't want to start a revolution from their bed? Not that Oasis started a revolution, or just stayed in bed. Three, when John Singleton is interviewed in the middle of the LA riots, he says Tyson wasn't convicted by a jury of his peers. He says a black man can go to jail for kicking a dog while Sun Ja Do is given probation for killing Latasha Harlins. Rodney King is who most people associate with this time, but the riots are about more. Tupac autographed looted copies of his CD and a week later said, I told you so. Latino men between 18 and 24 accounted for 30% of people arrested. Four, when JonBenet Ramsey's father started dating Natalie Holloway's mother, I couldn't tell if it was art or life being imitated, and by what. Some countries can't afford a good public relations team, so they cut back on things like cops. It might be cheaper to bury a middle-class white girl than pay someone to explain her body. And these are the calculations made every night before bed. Amy Winehouse is worth more than 50 cops, and you wouldn't have to train her. Get whoever you can afford. We made Anna Nicole Smith famous. Okay, so this next thing, I don't really don't know what it is, but I liked a title I came up with, so I just went with what came after. the title is, "My boyfriend left to get ice cream and ran into some friends, so I'm not sure when he'll be back or if we'll have ice cream." Hi. When I was 21, I lost a day. I mean, Thursday I said goodbye to my boyfriend who was driving south to deal with a drug charge. Then I went with my friend to visit these drug dealers she knew, took a Valium, a Xanax, and a Rohypnol, and eventually I smoked weed and dropped acid. My plan was to make the next 2 days go by as fast as possible, and I met someone. I remember meeting him and laughing a lot. I remember my friend saying I lost her wallet. She had left her purse with me there on my shoulder. I was too high to move, but when she came back, she took back the purse and couldn't find her wallet. She was furious that I would let somebody steal it. I couldn't remember anyone coming over and standing next to me since she'd gone, but I'd been eating the best chicken wings ever and not really paying attention, so I couldn't say for sure. She was so mad, and I don't remember where she found it, but she found her wallet and realized she hadn't left it in her purse at all. I don't know what I expected her to say at that point, but it wasn't that she was still mad at me, which she was. The problem was that she believed letting someone steal her wallet was something I'd do. I was so confused, and I'd met someone who got me away from her and took me to visit his friends. I remembered them from high school. They said I was tripping and gave me a pint of half and half out of their fridge. That they would have spare half and half to offer a person they kind of knew from high school made them seem very mature to me. I'm not sure if that was before or after the pool. I can remember how the water looked bright like any kind of light when your eyes have just adjusted to the dark. I remember not letting go of someone I'd met who was starting to become this warm presence I wasn't afraid of sinking into. I couldn't tell you what I was wearing, let alone remember where or how I'd put it on. For the life of me, I don't remember getting out. There were two cars. There was my car, which my boyfriend had borrowed for his trip after his beat-up Honda Civic broke down. That car continued to be part of my life long after I left my boyfriend, though I eventually lost it to someone in Sparks, Nevada. The point is, my car was more important to me than my boyfriend. At the time I lent it to him, I trusted few people more than my car, and for good reason, he was not one of those people. Still, I lent him my car. He'd been charged with possession and couldn't miss his court date. Even though I just found out he was doing cocaine and selling it to friends, I couldn't stand by and watch him miss his court date. But I wasn't happy. I wanted to forget I had a car and this terrible relationship I felt powerless in, which is why I said yes when my friend invited me to hang out at this drug dealer's house and why I said yes to every available drug but cocaine. I'm not sure if this was before or after the abortion, but it was definitely after he picked me up at a friend's house 4 or 5 hours late. In any case, I met someone who also had a car. I think it was a Lincoln. I remember he could start it with a remote control. I was impressed that he'd taken the time to make that possible. I think he liked how much I didn't know. He hadn't expected to stay at his friend's house so long, and somehow he'd lost his computer. I remember him looking for it everywhere in his car. He said it had been lost in the acid hole. Every time I remember there's such a thing as an acid hole, I see a white Lincoln with a red leather interior, which I think was actually the interior of one of my parents' Oldsmobiles during their Oldsmobile phase. That was right before the Toyota Camry phase. I remember wondering why the hell anyone would choose a 91 Camry over an Oldsmobile from the 80s. I woke up Sunday next to someone I'd met. The friend who I'd come with had followed the cocaine. Everyone had been looking for me. I called my boyfriend. My boyfriend had called my parents. He said he would pick me up. Many years later, a 21-year-old woman I would befriend would ask me if every woman who's into men has a story that involves waiting for a man who's asleep at home. I would tell her about losing a day and waking up to everyone looking for me. I didn't know how long my boyfriend would take to pick me up, which wouldn't have been so terrible if I'd forgotten I had a car and a boyfriend. I waited outside at a picnic table in the middle of the courtyard of an apartment complex. I didn't know how long I'd be there. Someone I'd met walked up, sat down next to me, and when my boyfriend came, he was gone. I told my 21-year-old friend I could still remember my boyfriend crying, thinking I would never stop tripping. I didn't think I was tripping, but didn't know. I called my mom and told her about the drugs. She opened some government handbook on illicit substances and read me the effects of the various drugs. It totally helped. I hadn't seen him come in, but there was a guy who sold weed for the dealer, and me and my friend visited that time I lost a day. Everyone was sure he'd stolen a pound of weed. They beat him up on the balcony. I didn't see it happen or the guy get kicked out, but I knew I was tripping when I walked out onto the balcony and couldn't stop staring at all the blood. Someone I'd met came up behind me and pulled me away. People are just great upon meeting. Let's say you meet someone and lose a day. It's like the day you lost. It feels abstracted, like it exists with a lost computer in an acid hole, even though the tech bubble has already burst and all these techies are leaving San Francisco, even though Y2K has already been memorialized in office space. All of your friends might be about to graduate college and accepting jobs in telemarketing, and the United States might have just persuaded Israel not to sell a fancy radar system to China. The US government might be cracking down on the sale of ecstasy, and one of your girlfriends might be the connect for a narc. And there you are watching Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, tripping with someone you've met, who calls into CompUSA and gets out of work so the two of you can keep hanging out. Someone you've met might seem so different while your boyfriend is somewhere getting a discount on a lawyer because the lawyer's son wants to join a fraternity at your university, and your ex-boyfriend is part of a fraternity and will do anything to make you happy, which is something that tends to happen too. Someone you've met will inevitably have to go back to work. He might need a new computer. He might have shot and buried his neighbor's cat. Okay. So one weird one, then one last one. I had this idea. I don't know if it will ever go anywhere, but I get obsessed with these stories about horrible things that happen, like in amusement parks or parks in general, because it seems so right that horrible things would happen there. And so I started like looking at all these stories that came out of these places, and the one that like kind of got me started was, I don't know if you guys saw it, but this summer there was, or in 2016, there was a kid in Missouri, I think. He was the son of a senator that like went down the world's tallest water slide and a horrible thing happened to him. Anyways, but so I wrote a poem about it. Veruft, the world's tallest water slide. The safety netting isn't there to save you more than keep you from killing someone else. Call it protection, insurance that costs you 10 times the maintenance of the ride to contain your death and pay off your family. The park can be closed no more than 3 days before park-ending loss of profit, before everyone who witnessed what happened starts to think something went wrong. It wasn't anything you did different. A contingency plan was prepared in the case of you. These kids are service workers. These jobs are seasonal. At this point, the machines basically run themselves. Okay. And last. What sucks the most about loss, when you lose someone, you don't lose them all at once. You lose them in pieces over time so that a long time can pass and wonderful things can happen. And one day you smell or hear or see something and remember, and not only is it painful to remember the person missing, it's painful to realize it's been a while since you've remembered, that your surroundings are more and more reflecting your life without them, and that in a sense you're still losing them, and that the grieving process might in the end be about learning to live with the ongoingness of that. Thanks.